From Harrisburg to Latrobe, Everett to Pittston, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, lawmakers are working to crack down on so-called puppy mills, which raise dogs, cats, and other animals under inhumane conditions. State Representative Jason Ortitai is here with details. Continuing our discussion of all things canine, Joe Geiger has Joan Klinger of Dog Tags, an organization that provides service dogs to vets with PTSD, in this week's Community Benefit Spotlight. And there has been much commentary about President Trump's brash style. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College contrasts that with Ronald Reagan on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to State Representative Jason Ortitai in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Philadelphians are paying more for soda. Could Pittsburghers be paying more for pop? Not if State Representative Mark Mustio has his way. Mustio, a Republican state representative from Allegheny County, has introduced a bill that would prevent cities and other municipalities from placing taxes on beverages, food, or containers. If passed into law, the bill would invalidate Philadelphia's soda tax, which has harmed grocers and placed an additional tax burden on consumers. Although the bill has attracted bipartisan support, something rare in Harrisburg, it is opposed by the American Heart Association, which is fighting to cut down on the amount of sugary drinks consumed. The Pennsylvania House of Representatives Health Committee this week passed a bill which the Commonwealth Foundation says will, quote, restore the dignity of work for healthy adults enrolled in Medicaid. The bill establishes work or community service requirements for able-bodied adults receiving Medicaid benefits. Elizabeth Stell of the Commonwealth Foundation said, quote, people are happier and healthier when they take pride in their work. Protecting the vulnerable while helping people transition from dependency to self-sufficiency should be a priority for lawmakers. Other states have already seen success in implementing Medicaid work requirements in other welfare programs. Incumbency has its advantages, one of which is usually a healthier war chest. And so it is that incumbent U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. prepares for a general election battle with over $10 million in the bank. On the Republican side, Congressman Lou Barletta reports having $1.6 million on hand, but he faces primary opposition from State Representative Jim Christiana, who reported raising less than $20,000. If he prevails in the primary, Barletta can count on help from President Trump, who recruited him into the race, to help close that funding gap. And finally, some good news for shoppers. Struggling retailer Bon-Ton said last week it has an offer from an investor group interested in purchasing the chain. If the sale goes through, it would prevent the closure of more than 40 stores, including 8 in Pennsylvania. The investor group includes DW Partners, Namdar Realty Group, and the Washington Prime Group. Brick-and-mortar retailers have had a difficult time competing against online retailers, which have gobbled up a big chunk of the market. Bon-Ton is headquartered in York, Pennsylvania. Read about all things Pennsylvania at the all-new patownhall.com. Some breeders keep dogs, cats, and other animals in horrific conditions in order to maximize profits when selling them to pet stores. Some of these puppy mills are right here in Pennsylvania, and State Representative Jason Ortitai is crafting legislation to put an end to the practice. He joins us now with details. Jason, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Jason, you have introduced some legislation, and it's undergoing some refinement, but your goal is to eliminate puppy mills. Before we talk about your specific bill, over the last couple of years, there was a rescue dog by the name of Libre. He gained a lot of notoriety. There was a law passed in his name. Can you just tell us a bit about what Libre's law did, and then we're going to talk about your bill and why it is different and necessary?
Libre's law was more about protecting animals and the fact that they had already been adopted, they'd been purchased, making sure that people were taking care of them properly in their homes. One big thing, particularly back home, is you can't leave them outside for a certain period of time, especially if it's snowing or raining or it's really cold outside or it's really hot. Those are the type of protections that were in Libre's law. Now, in this bill, what we're really trying to go after are the commercial breeders who are not giving basically similar protections, but they're not providing humane shelters or humane living quarters for these animals. And in some cases, you see that they basically fail inspections. There's excessive feces all over their cages. They have very small cages in some of these places. There's multiple warnings, citations, violations, failed inspections, and basically they just live in places that if you look at it and you saw it, you'd be like, well, how can anyone put a puppy in an environment like that? And that's what my bill really does. The big issue that we've been running into, and this is why I'm trying to refine it and change some things, is when you say puppy mill, there's no real legal definition of a puppy mill out there. There's no real puppy mill definition in any Pennsylvania statute or law. So in the initial draft of my legislation, we have puppy mill in there, but it doesn't really relate to anything. So what I'm trying to do is change that over, because what is actually defined in statute are commercial kennels and commercial breeders. Now, a lot of people are familiar with the Horrible 100. Pennsylvania is home to 12 of the Horrible 100 quote-unquote puppy mills. And as I said before, multiple violations, citations, failed inspections, vet orders, a various number of dogs, or they're selling underage puppies. There's a lot of different things that go into this. But what we're trying to do is, I'm not trying to put the responsible commercial breeders out of business, because over since 2008, I think, is when the last update to the dog law was passed, we've actually seen about a 50% cut in commercial breeders in the state of Pennsylvania because of all the facility upgrades they had to get. People have had to pour hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars into these facilities, and some of them are really nice. Heck, actually, I'm jealous of some of these places because they're like little mini condos for these puppies. When we look at that stuff, what I'm trying to do is get these other commercial breeders who are not doing it responsible out of business. And what I would like to do is, with all the pet stores that we have out there, have them start sourcing animals like puppies and kittens and rabbits from the Humane Society and the humane shelters. Because right now, like the Washington County Humane Society and the Allegheny County Humane Society and Animal Friends and all the other shelters that are out there, they're overflowing with animals. And some of these places, they can be kill shelters, and we just have a mass overpopulation. So I think by partnering up, by making stores partner up with the humane shelters, that one, they can get some of these animals out of there, and they'd be good pets too. And actually, on top of that, Pets Plus Natural has 5 locations throughout the state where they've already converted and have a humane model like this, where they used to sell commercial bred animals, but now they don't. And they've actually been quite profitable in doing that. The other thing this bill does is it removes the loophole in the outdoor sales law. Under the current law, a licensed kennel can sell a dog at any public place in the Commonwealth. But under this bill, that exemption is going to be removed. And what I'm finding, and you know, I have a lot of friends and family that have purchased dogs from various breeders throughout the country. What they do is that they don't go to like a flea market or, you know, meet in a parking lot somewhere. They actually go to the place where the dog is actually bred, so they can meet the mom who delivered the puppy. They can see the living environment that puppy was raised in, and they purchase the puppy on site and they bring it home. And the last part of the bill is actually about providing transparency and advertising. All we're asking to do is that when someone advertises that they have a puppy for sale, that they include their license number in all the advertisements. Because what we're finding is there's still a little bit of a black market out there where people aren't getting licensed, they aren't getting inspected, they're just selling their dogs, and there's real no way to keep anyone accountable if something happens to that puppy, where if they get sick or if they ultimately they die right away. There is a puppy lemon law, but you know, if they are not inspected and they're not licensed, then at the end of the day, who's going to hold them accountable? So those are the basics that are in the bill. What I'm trying to do is make sure the terminology actually matches what statute is, so it has the determined effect at the end of the day.
We are talking with State Representative Jason Ortitai, and we're talking about efforts to cut down on puppy mills and the sales of puppies that are bred in unhealthy conditions for the puppy and for the humans who adopt them, by the way. So, Jason, what I'm understanding from what you said here is that your bill would not completely outlawed the commercial breeding of dogs, cats, and other animals. How does the bill address the issue of what is a puppy mill, and a puppy mill being animals bred in unhealthy conditions, unsanitary conditions, as opposed to a commercial breeder who may be out there breeding specific breeds in order to have purebreds? Now, there's a complete difference between the two. So how does the bill differentiate between those activities?
If you look at the ASPCA's definition, their definition of a puppy mill is a large-scale commercial dog breeding operation where profit is given priority over the well-being of the dogs. Now, I've seen a couple of these facilities where they are not putting profit over the well-being of the dogs, where, like I said, I'm jealous of some of these living conditions that some of these puppies are raised in, because they're so clean and they're so nice. They have heated and air conditioning. And like I said, those are the ones that I'm not going after. Like, a lot of those places are the pure breed ones that you had mentioned. And what I'm trying to do is to make sure that those ones stay open. Those are fine. They're doing things the right way. The problem in the details is figuring out how we put this in legislation to differentiate between the two of them. And I think the way to go about that is to look at, all right, you've had so many citations and violations and failed inspections, and you've done nothing to change the conditions of your facility. And my thought was, well, let's say, you know what, if you have so many citations or violations and you fail your inspection, guess what? You're shut down and you cannot reopen until you've addressed every one of these concerns. But then the next question comes up, and the unintended consequences is, what happens to the existing animals that are there? Do they put them down? Do they sell them? Where do they go? And how do you have any sort of accountability that the animal is actually healthy and is going to survive? Because, I mean, I haven't purchased a dog like this before, but I know they're expensive. If someone's going to lay down a few $1,000s for a purebred dog, they want to know that that dog's going to live longer than 30 or 60 days and not going to have medical issues for the rest of its life. And that's the part that I have had significant trouble with in addressing in this bill. And I know Senator Reschenthaler has introduced a companion bill in the Senate. He has actually changed it. My bill actually would fit into existing dog law. His bill, he changed it to the crimes code, where they would actually be fined. I believe it's $500 or $1,000 per violation.
Sounds like Senator Reschenthaler is onto something here, Jason, because if we have a situation right now, I gather from what you are saying that we do have inspections of these facilities. They get cited. They don't correct the problems for which they have been cited. Is it also a matter of there just isn't enough of teeth in the current law, and what we need to do here is to ratchet up fines and perhaps other criminal penalties, up to and including incarceration, if people are cited repeatedly and do not take steps to correct the problem?
I agree, because, I mean, you're getting right into it, to animal cruelty right there. And sometimes the only way people listen is if you hit them in the wallet, or you threaten to put them in jail. And the other part of this too, and I don't want to put, and I'm not certainly not throwing the Department of Agriculture under the bus or anyone else, but there's just not enough inspectors out there to inspect all these locations. And sometimes they only get to these places like once a year, or sometimes once every other year. And that's on us and the government to make sure that we have a well-funded staff over there to do these inspections and do them properly and correctly. Because I think we can all agree, we don't want to see these animals grow up in inhumane conditions where basically it's torturous. I mean, I just saw a story in the paper the other day where two dogs were hung, and it was like at one of these puppy mill locations because they were sick. And you see that, and you know your heart just wrenches it when you hear stuff like that. So that's what we're trying to get away from. But I do agree, Senator Reschenthaler is onto something, and I think if we can take what he's done and put the definitions in there, then I think we have a really good bill that's got some really good teeth in it that can really be enacted in a good place.
In terms of the Humane Society shelters, now, of course, we know the Humane Society is a nonprofit organization, so they're doing what they're doing out of a sense of mission to care for the animals. They're not trying to make a profit. Your legislation wouldn't affect them in any way. I assume there are other laws, other regulations that regulate those type of nonprofit shelters. Would your bill affect them in any way?
I don't believe so. I look, when I adopted the two cats that I have now, I went through a humane shelter, and I think it was, we made a donation. I think it was $100 for two kittens, and to me that was a fair price. And I think they were $50 for, or $60 for one. Like the same rules and regulations would apply to them. Most of theirs are they're all rescues. And there are a ton of them out there. There are a ton of nonprofits outside the Humane Society that have rescue animals. They have vets on staff there to take care of the animals until they're ultimately adopted. So there's nothing in this legislation that would affect them in the terms of how they would distribute or sell their animals or take donations. What it would do is allow them to work more closely with the stores. And they're already allowed to do that anyway, but I think it would help clear out some of the shelters and get rid of some of the overpopulation of some of these places.
We again have been talking with State Representative Jason Ortitai. He represents the 46th State Legislative District, that located in Washington and Allegheny counties in southwestern Pennsylvania. Jason, if we have listeners who would like to learn more, who would like to track the progress of your bill to try to protect our four-footed friends, where can they go to get that information?
Sure, absolutely. They can go to www.reportitai.com, and that's www.reportitai.com.
State Representative Jason Ortitai. Jason, thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
Service dogs are a great comfort to veterans who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Dog Tags is an organization working to provide those vets with service dogs. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation talks with Joan Klinger of Dog Tags. Joe?
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Joan, for being a guest in the Lincoln Radio program.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Joan, you're a board member in a pretty neat organization called Dog Tags. Share with the listeners a little bit about your organization.
Dog Tags was founded 2012, I think. It started with a friend of mine calling and saying, would you come and test for CGC for one of my, I have two veterans I'm training.
What would CGC be?
Canine Good Citizen.
Thank you.
And they happened to be working in an airplane hangar over at the New Cumberland Airport. And that's where we originally started. And we started with two veterans. It moved up to five veterans. We moved to a VFW that accommodated us, the Lower Allen Township VFW. And we are now up to somewhere around 60 to 70 veterans that we work with on a weekly basis. So we have grown just exponentially, and it has just been absolutely wonderful.
And what would the profile of these veterans be?
When we originally started, it was they had to be combat veterans suffering from PTSD or traumatic brain injury. And we have since revised, because too many of them are no longer combat veterans, it has to be service-related, that they have traumatic brain injury or some kind of post-traumatic stress. And the VA has to have a diagnosis, and they send them to us. The veterans hear about us either from their group plans when they are working at the VA or just by word of mouth. We go out. I talk at different organizations. We have outings where we set up at different functions, and people come and talk to us, and we give them brochures. And they contact us, and if they fulfill the requirements, we bring them into the organization. We're a little bit different from most service dog organizations because we are training their own dogs, if we can, to be their service dogs. If the veteran does not have a dog, we will find them. We're affiliated with a couple of the different rescues in the area, the Harrisburg Humane Society. We have someone there who tells us, hey, I think we have a good dog here, and we have two people, Tim and Kristen, go out and they test the dog, they check it out, and they try and match the dog to a veteran, and then they join our program, and we have training four different levels, and they end with, hopefully, a public access test and a certified service dog.
That's terrific. I know each veteran is unique in their own way, but what are some of the typical challenges that veterans with PTSD would have?
Most of the time, what they share is that the PTSD, they have short attention span. They can't deal with people in a crowd. It's as though you have to walk out your front door every morning and be constantly super alert that somebody's going to shoot you or come after you.
Sure. And what kind of a profile does the organization look for in the service dog?
They cannot be a guard dog. Service dogs are never allowed to guard you. That is not their function. Their function is to help you, assist you in daily living. Some of the veterans, because they've been jumping out of airplanes or back of trucks with 100-pound packs on their back, they have major back and leg issues. So we will teach the dog to go, oh, I dropped my keys. The dog will go get your keys for you. They will go pick up the phone for you. They will go and retrieve objects because you can't do it. We teach the dogs to brace so that, now these are the bigger dogs, so that the veteran can use the dog to get up from a chair or from the floor. We teach the dogs to watch my back. Whatever the veteran needs, that's what we try and do. We have a cot that we bring down, and the veteran is lying on the cot, and we teach the dog. Some of them have night terrors, and the dog will lie across their chest, and that's enough to compress them and give them that feeling of security that they'll wake up. If they can't touch the veteran, we teach the dogs, we teach them to turn on a light. You know, there's touch lights. So the dog will turn on the light and bark at the person. Or for two of the veterans, they pull the covers off of them.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program, and my guest today is Joan Klinger, a board member with an organization called Dog Tags. What should the citizens in the community be aware of when you see in your community someone with a service dog? What is the etiquette or protocol?
Do not approach, and this is something that the veterans have a real issue with. They say, we're out there in a store, and these people say, can I pet your dog? And I say, no, he's working. And they go, oh, okay, and they start petting him. Or they just come up, the one lady has this beautiful little toy poodle. The toy poodle alerts on her low blood sugar. If they are touching and petting the dog, she can't do her job. So if it's got a service dog vest on, you do not interact with the dog. The dog is supposed to stay focused on the person. If you ask, can I pet your dog? And some of them want their dogs to be petted because it takes the attention away from the person and onto the dog, and it makes it easier for the veteran to deal with interaction with a stranger. Do not ever go up and just start petting the dog and interacting with the dog. That's a big no-no. Some of the veterans will tell us that they can now get out in public because people aren't looking at them, they're looking at the dog. So the attention has now changed from them to the dog. Even though they're not allowed to interact with the dog, they're looking at the dog and they're not looking at the veteran and trying to interact with him or her. And it helps them.
Joan, how does your organization raise funds? About what size is your organizational budget, and how do you get that revenue?
We pay for everything for the veterans. We pay for the leash, the treats, the collar, because we want them to use a specific kind of leash and collar. When they have passed their tests, we provide them with the service dog vest in training, and then we give them the final vest that says service dog with the dog tags emblem on it. We provide everything for the dog. Somebody figured out that if you counted up everything that we pay for the dog, nobody gets paid. So we figured it costs somewhere around $4,000 to $5,000 to train one dog. It depends on how long it takes to train the dog, how many hours they spend in the training facility. We train every Friday, and they're supposed to continue training during the week. We do outings sometimes, different places on weekends and in the evenings, and some of the veterans will attend those. But everyone there works for free.
Joan, if somebody listening to the program wants to learn more about Dog Tags, how can they find you?
DogTagsProgram.org.
Well, this is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Joan Klinger, who serves as a volunteer board member for an organization in the Harrisburg region named Dog Tags. Joan, thank you for being a guest on the radio program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is hard to find two presidents with completely different styles than Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an interesting story on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Once again, the presidential historians and scholars are at work crafting rankings of our nation's best and worst presidents. And among them, Ronald Reagan continues to rank very high. Speaking of Reagan, as a Reagan biographer, I always get asked questions about Ronald Reagan at this time of year, especially concerning his personality and character, and particularly in comparison to the current president. Well, there's so much I could say about that, but I'll share this. Ronald Reagan was plainly likable. And central to that likability was his humility. The word I didn't dominate his lexicon, unless he was poking fun at himself. In keeping with a biblical exhortation read to him as a boy by his devout mother, Nell Reagan, Reagan humbled himself. He did not exalt himself. On that, I'd like to share an anecdote about Ronald Reagan told me by Bill Clark, who had been Reagan's closest advisor. As a senior official, Clark had a driver, a man named Joe Bullock, a Georgia native who moved to Washington during the Great Depression. Joe, a black man, had suffered the cruel Jim Crow laws that plagued the South. He went to Washington for a better life. Joe first found employment as a mule driver. He eventually traded in the animal for, well, senior government officials, who were much more difficult to navigate. One morning, Bill Clark's father visited Washington. He hit it off with Joe right away. A rancher, he gave Joe a gift, a Western-style belt with a kind of John Wayne belt buckle, as Clark described it. Joe Bullock loved it, proudly displaying it by leaving his suit jacket unbuttoned all the time. That belt soon assumed a life of its own. There was an upcoming state visit by England's Prince Philip. It was customary that the White House provide a gift. Clark and Reagan and a few others brainstormed. Clark suggested a belt. "Well, what does it look like?" asked Reagan. Clark noted that he had a model in the car. "Send him up," ordered President Reagan. Joe entered via the door of Reagan's personal secretary. He had worked for the federal government for 50 years, Joe did, but never got within 50 yards of a president. He saw Clark, Vice President Bush, the senior aides, and then the President of the United States. Overcome, big old Joe, 6'4", began weeping. He had come so far since Jim Crow and the Great Depression. No one in the room was prepared for that. They were dead silent, clueless as to how to respond, except for Ronald Reagan. The president rose, walked over to the driver, extended his hand, breathed in, and said matter-of-factly, "Mr. Bullock, I understand you have a belt to show me." It was an everyman touch by Reagan, a basic respect that put Joe instantly at ease. Businesslike, Joe showed the belt, and then he and Reagan swapped stories, chatting away. The rest of us, Bill Clark told me, just faded away as the two got along famously. Joe Bullock left with a story to tell his fellow drivers and his grandchildren. He died a few years later, and I mention this story now because Joe's daughter contacted me just last week to share this story with Joe's grandchildren. This anecdote is nothing dramatic. It's simply another nice story that I've heard about Ronald Reagan, a good man and a good president. This country has been blessed with many of them, and that's a thought worth bearing in mind as we consider the people who ask us for their presidential vote. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 23 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including our newest affiliate, WBUQ-FM at Bloomsburg University. Welcome to our new listeners at Bloomsburg U. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.